We are delighted that y'all are all here. Those of you I haven't met, I'm Brian. This is my friend Justin.
Nice to see you.
And we are very excited to be into our summer edition of Theology on Tuesdays. We are keeping going all summer long. So you may have thought summer was for the beach, but it's actually for Theology on Tuesdays. So come and bring your friends. And it's great. We have a lot of people that are here for the first time tonight. So please be friendly and introduce yourself if you're a regular. But we are excited to be here. And one of the things you may notice is we have these little sheets that are around and about. And there are some QR codes on them, which is sort of ironic because this book that we're talking about, one of the things he says is that the QR codes are part of the machine and we should resist QR codes. But please do not resist QR codes tonight because they help us. So the top QR code, if you have any question at all, you can use that to anonymously pose the question and everyone will see the question but not who asked it. And then you can upvote the ones that are interesting and we'll try to address those. Also, very important, right under that is another QR code to join our email list. So part of the way that we get word out about Theology on Tuesdays and about other things that are going on with sort of our young adult ministry is through our email list. So I would encourage you, if you're not on that, to go ahead and sign up. You can always unsubscribe if you feel like we're sending you too many emails. We try to restrain ourselves. But also, you might want to mark your calendar for our June dates, June 9th and June 23rd. Hope you can join us. We will be most likely in the Whiskey Room all summer. Every occasionally we may be down in the coffee lounge, but mostly up here. So keep that in mind. We'd love to have you, love to have any of your friends. That would be great. So any other announcements that you can think of?
No, I think that's it.
All right. So I know several people were a little bit worried that they were coming into part two of our discussion of Against the Machine and that you were not here for part one. But let me just allay your fears. If you were not here for part one, you don't really need to worry about that because we will recap a little bit about the main themes of the book as we go through the night. So we're just glad that you're here, but we do highly recommend this book. It's a great one, and we've been joking that some of you may have noticed there's been a lot of news about Pope Leo just issued his first encyclical, which is sort of a theological reflection on a particular topic, and we decided he listened to our session from last time because it has a Tolkien quote in it, and then it goes on about progress and being against the machine. So you're welcome,
it's
Pope
nice
Leo.
To, nice to have a great audience.
Yes, yeah. Yes. So it's good. So basically, what we wanted to do was to recap some of the main themes of Against the Machine. For those of you that are new to it, it's a book that was on the New York Times bestseller list for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, written by a public intellectual named Paul Kingsnorth, who has a very interesting life story. He started off as a radical environmentalist, maybe kind of even an eco-terrorist, deeply committed to the environment and to nature. He sort of progressed through that. Well, I don't know if progressed is the right word, but he went into being a Wiccan after that. It was a little unusual, and felt that that was really not satisfying. And then he went through a really profound conversion to Orthodox Christianity. And all through his life, part of what he has been writing about and thinking about is, what does it mean to be human? And part of what he says is that to be human is to understand that you are made in the image of God, that you are born into a body that is either a male or female body, and that you are going to be alive for a period of years, and then you will die. And that those are sort of the conditions of what humanity means, but you have the capacity to create and experience wonder and beauty and meaning. So he is a big fan of being human. And the subtitle of the book, Against the Machine, is The Unmaking of Humanity. And sort of his thesis is that the omnipresence of technology, particularly computers and cell phones, all of these things, that they are the physical manifestation of what he calls the machine, and that technology is really taking over so much of what used to be left to our humanity to figure out, and that we are in some ways becoming cogs in this big machine where we are being driven by all of that. So that's sort of what he's talking about. Do you want to add anything to that?
I think that's a good... So he's not just against, in some sense, a literal machine. He certainly is against some of the unintended consequences of, say, the Industrial Revolution and the rise in technology like smartphones, and considering what is this doing to humanity. But he also talks about the machine as kind of this force that it's hard to put your finger on. It is also a way of viewing the world. Mm-hmm. He talks about this may be a good way to go into the four S's, right? I don't know if those are equivalent to the machine, but he talks about
I think they are.
Sex, scientism, not just science, but scientism, self, and screens. All of those sort of comprise the machine. It's this. It's both technology, but it's also this drive to an individualistic culture that's about efficiency and money and everybody just being productive to some end, right? And one of the reasons I made you read this book, I felt like, after pestering you, was so much of what we've talked about. We both love Lewis and Tolkien, but the abolition of man, I mean, these are themes that Lewis talked about almost 100 years ago, and he really is drawing out not only kind of how we got here, but he's a really good... has anybody actually read the book since last time? You don't have to, but I'm curious if anybody has gone out and checked it out. Okay, great, actually, because then we'll be able to give some insights.
Yes.
A lot of it is from his blogs, apparently, mm-hmm. that he's got a great... I don't know what his blog is, but the chapters read as if they are little blog posts, pretty
much. Yeah, one of the great ironies is that he decided to go completely off the grid and move to rural Ireland with his family and grow vegetables, which is kind of awesome, in County Galway, which is beautiful. But he makes his living off his Substack. So he is continually engaged with the machine and with technology. So he talks about, and one of the things I appreciate about the book is that he's conflicted about a lot of things. There are things that he thinks, you know, there's some parts of this that are really great, but then there are other things about it that are really terrible, that are robbing us of our humanity. And there's a lot of resonance with Tolkien. One of the things I really appreciate about Tolkien and Lewis is they had really, I think, a prophetic understanding of what progress, with a capital P, was going to do to the world, and that our engagement with technology was maybe the tables were going to be turned. The technology would not serve us, but we would be serving technology. And part of what Justin was getting at is he talks a lot in this book about how so many people feel like the purpose of their life is to make the most money that they can. And that if you can make the most money that you can and have the most prestigious job, that somehow that makes you valuable. And he pushes back really hard against that and says that this whole construct that says money equals happiness is really an innovation, and that all the statistics will tell you that it's not true. You know, we live in an age where there's more anxiety and depression and loneliness than since they've started keeping records of these things. And he thinks that's directly connected to this role of the machine. So there's four S's. When he talks about self as one of those, he says part of the problem with our culture is that we've been taught that it's all about me. And it's all about my satisfaction, it's about my happiness, about my well-being. And if you or a relationship or anything else gets in the way of that, then I just cut off whatever that other thing is, because I need to be true to myself. And he says the problem with that is it makes you the king of your own world, but it's not a very happy kingdom. And so it doesn't actually work. And he says that is deeply connected to our elevation of this idea that our sexuality and the expression of our sexuality is like the most defining characteristic about us. And he says that if you look at the history of the world, it's bizarre. Yeah. No other culture has ever defined themselves in terms of their sexuality and sexual pleasure to the extent that ours does. And he says that that robs you, again, of your humanity and reduces you to sort of this Lego view that you're like Legos made out of meat. That's what your body and your humanity is, and that is a profoundly depressing thing.
And that's only of the last 10, 20 years that sexuality has become so important. But one of the things I love about Lewis, understanding the self, but is you look at progress and specifically kind of scientism going down that route. That really is what began this understanding that we should manipulate the natural world for our own ends.
Yeah.
And I think we should maybe talk a little bit about, I don't know if we talked about this last time, but saying that you're against progress sounds really bad. And so what would Lewis say is dangerous about progress, quote unquote, or capital P
progress?
Yeah,
so he would have a lot to say about that. But one of my favorite things that he says about progress is that progress is like this, progress with a capital P in quotation marks, it's like this inexorable movement toward the next biggest, better, more improved, more efficient, make more money, it's going to be the greatest thing ever. And that the problem with that is that when you fully embrace that narrative, you are not paying attention to what the ultimate destination is. It's like you went to the airport and just got on a plane, and you had no idea where the plane is going. And part of what Lewis says, and he uses the analogy of a car, he says if you're driving somewhere and you realize that you are heading not to the destination that you wanted to, but toward the wrong destination, the smartest and wisest person is the one who does the first U-turn. And he says progress is like that. It's like being on the superhighway going in the wrong direction, and that resisting that, being against that, when you understand that the progress is going to rob you of your humanity in a lot of ways, that the first person to turn around is the one that is wise, that will actually live the life that is full of joy.
Yeah, I think it's that impulse to just create and innovate and push the envelope in whatever field, the infatuation with that idea, with losing sight of, as you said, where you're heading. And just because we can do something, what are the consequences looking at? And this is where Lewis was so prophetic in some ways, looking forward. Where does this lead? And I appreciate he doesn't bog down in the last 40 years. Kingsnorth does. He doesn't bog down in that. But he goes back to some pretty significant shifts in the world, where, like, talking about factories, talking
yep.
about the steam engine and things like that. And what does that do? As good as those gifts are, what are some of the implications for our humanity and our relationships? And one of the things we did say last time was, you know, it's so easy to hop on a plane and go any number of time zones in one day, to travel the United States, the relatively cheap cost of doing so now. But what that does is it uproots you in many ways. And so there are these, as good as that is, and to be able to see more of the world, there are also these consequences of you don't view yourself in this web of relationships.
Right.
And instead, to maintain that, you have to often utilize cheap substitutes of disembodied connection.
Yes. Yeah, and one of the other things that he talks about, when he talks about scientism and science are not the same thing. Scientism is the worship of science, basically, and the idea that science is the only way to know anything, and part of what that means is that wonder and mystery are automatically ruled out, that you don't want wonder and mystery. You just want to be cold, hard facts. You don't want emotional ways of knowing. You just want rationality and intellect. So the S's, he says, you want to avoid those. But I think part of what his prescription for flourishing in the midst of all of this stuff is to re-embrace the four P's. And the four P's are prayer, which he uses for worship, place, the past, and people. And so one of the things about those things is that they seem not very sexy in a way. They seem sort of old-fashioned. But he says that is exactly the point. And so one of the things he says about prayer and worship is that being part of a worshiping community in the way that people traditionally understood what it meant to be part of a worshiping community, to be present with the same group of people week after week after week after week, worshiping together, anchors your soul spiritually, but it also anchors you in community in a really profound way. And it's not the same as listening to a good Bible podcast in your car every morning on your way to work. I mean, great, it's probably better to listen to a Bible podcast than some of the other things that are out there, but that's not a substitute. And that's what's happened in our culture, is we feel like we've kind of checked the spiritual box when we do that. And he says this embodied reality, all of these P's are embodied, that we need to be physically present, connected to where we can reach over and touch someone. And you can't do that in a podcast. So I think that that whole idea of making that a priority, and so many of us, particularly in y'all's generation, every weekend we're going out of town. We're going for this bachelorette party or this wedding or this thing or that thing and trying to be connected with those people. But the problem with that is if you go to the extreme, you disconnect yourself from being part of a community that you're rooted in.
Yeah, one of the things tonight I think we're excited about doing is looking at those four P's. And in many ways, the church, when you look at the scriptures, the people, place, prayer, and past, the church has a unique contribution in each of those areas, the Christian faith in particular. And so we want to talk about some practices to keep the alliteration going for those four P's. What would be some things that come to your mind that help us resist this, the four S's and the kind of the machine, which I think we all on some degree recognize, yeah, that's not good. I don't like some. I don't like my relationship with my phone. Just about everybody that I know will admit to that to some degree. But how do you actually still live in the world as it is? The chances of our cell phones going away are pretty small.
Yeah, yeah.
But what does it look like practically? What are some practices that we can embody and practice that will enable us to live faithfully and well in this age?
Yeah, I think one of the great things you can try to do is to find some co-conspirators, to find some other people that want to push back against all of this and make a pact with each other to do things like, we're going to go to church together on Sunday. We're going to worship together. We're going to go have a meal together after church. Those kinds of things where if you have somebody that you're accountable to, it's much easier to not get up and go to church if no one is expecting you to be there. But if you have friends that you've committed to be there, you're much more likely to go. So I think praying that God would give you some co-conspirators, being willing to go out on a limb and suggest that to some of your friends, even though they might think you were sort of weird, that you're trying to push back against some of this stuff, you can be countercultural in that way. So I think that's a great practice. Another practice, and a number of these are in that book, The Common Rule, that we've talked about before in here. One of the practices he recommends is making sure that every day you have a meal with other people. Now, that does not mean that you go into Chick-fil-A and order your sandwich and then sit in the restaurant instead of your car. That is not with other people. That is in a building. That is not with people. But he means actually taking the initiative to talk to someone and then plan to share table fellowship together around some food. And that requires advanced planning, which we don't like because our phone makes it possible for us to do everything at the last minute where we don't have to make commitments. But push back against that. Planning out, you know, at the beginning of the week, I'm going to have a meal with this person this day, or I'm going to invite these people for dinner this day and light a candle and have flowers on the table. All of those embodied sort of practices of being together are huge. Place is another one. And as I said last week, when you live in Charleston, You've got place and past already, sort of, you're up to 50% already compared to if you lived in a faraway suburb of Kansas City or something like that. Sorry if you're from Kansas City. But we're surrounded by the past. I mean, we're in a beautiful old building tonight. We worship in a beautiful old building. Embrace the place that you're in. So many people live in Charleston and they never lean into the beauty of Charleston. Get up and go walk on the Battery at sunrise. Go to the beach and go wading at sunrise or at sunset. Walk out to the Morris Island Lighthouse with some friends. There are all of these incredible things you can do here. They don't cost any money, but they will help you to be more invested in your place. Or if you're like me, where if you spend the money, it'll make you do something, spend the money and join Middleton Place. And then you can go as much as you want to and just walk in those beautiful gardens, which will seem like it's for free after you get over the sticker shock of buying the membership. But you also, if you don't ever go, if you're like me, you'll feel bad that you spent that money and you didn't go, so it'll make you go. So I think those are some practices. And learn about the past. Learn about your family. Learn about your roots. Ask questions to the older people in your family. Talk about what was valuable in their growing up experience. What are traditions in your family? All those kinds of things are practices that will help you push back against all of that. Yeah, all right, that was a lot.
That was a lot. I don't know.
I'm kind of fired up
about
this.
I'm tempted just to respond with, the impulse you have of joining Middleton Place, it makes you go, well, the gym doesn't have the same effect on me. I've joined and
well, it obviously does not have that effect on me either.
It's all right. But I do think that all of those, I mean, there's so many different practices that we could talk about, but one of the things that I thought was really insightful is this kind of, the idea of the machine and resisting it. It's first and foremost a way of viewing the world. It's a story in and of itself. And so he actually talks about in there that the first step to dismantling the machine is not revolution or monkey wrenching, he says, but to stop believing the story.
Yeah.
And I think about Romans chapter 12, don't be conformed to the pattern of this age, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And I think that's so important. You've talked about people and past, and in a sense, yes, Charleston is that, but also it's so much more. Viewing yourself as a web, in a web of relationships,
yes.
Not just today, but down through history. So you talked about learning your family tree. That was something, gosh, it took until my children were like 10 before I even started thinking about, I want to know who I am. That's so weird, actually. If you look at 99.999% of human civilization, they knew who their people were.
Right.
Like down hundreds of years before, where they came from, who their people were, and what they held to. And he says, we've gotten away from that to our own detriment. And it's important for us to, I think, go deeper in there. But learning the way that the world operated. So history is one of the compelling things, I think. Read a history book. Read about how people lived for most all of humanity and realize you have more in common with them, whether you like it or not. We like to think we are so radically different. This is the chronological snobbery that C.S. Lewis talks about.
That we're the best because we happen to be alive now.
I can get on a plane.
All those stupid people in the past, like Aristotle.
I have cell phones. I can do all these things that everybody else can't.
So obviously you're more cool.
Well, not only are you more cool, but therefore what they have to say doesn't really apply to me in my context. And that's such a dangerous thing to fall into.
Slippery slope.
Because what ultimately gets, what makes life worth living is looking out at the goal of it all. What is all of this for, right? If progress is moving towards something, you need to know what that something is. And again, that's where the Christian faith and actually the wisdom of the past, even apart from the Christian faith, they had better answers for what this life was for. You have a duty to your neighbor, to society. Life is found in not just accumulating your own comfort in life, but pouring yourself out for others. And then obviously the Christian faith would add on to that and say life is ultimately about pursuing God and knowing him and being in relationship with him and his people. So I would say history and the history of the church, the history of the world, and view yourself in that lens, and it will renew your mind in a way that boy, I feel so strange when I live in the last like 5-10 years, and what we're doing is just a really bizarre thing. And that's helpful, I think, not to look down upon the age that we're in, but to rightly understand it in light of the whole.
And to say you can be, it's just like when Jesus says that he, in his high priestly prayer in John 17, right before his crucifixion, he's praying for his followers, and he says he doesn't want God to take them out of the world, but to leave them in the world, but that they should be in the world, but not of it. And I think that's part of what this means about not believing the story that the machine is trying to tell you. And part of all of these practices, all of the practices that start with a P, is slowing down. We don't live with margin. Most of us live in what I would call a state of routine panic, and we are constantly right at the edge of, you know, we're always late. We always have 400 different things that we're trying to do. And he talks a lot in here about limits, and that we are designed to be finite, and that that's good, and that limits are good, and that slowing down and making yourself slow down is good. If I had written this book, I would have added an additional P, which would have been poetry. Oh. Poetry is one of the things that I think helps make us human. It makes us slow down, and it makes us engage with wonder and mystery and beauty. And in every age up until where we are now, most people were deeply aware of poetry if they lived in any kind of civilized place. And now it's very rare. But poetry, just by its nature, makes you slow down, and it makes you embrace your humanity.
I was going exactly in that direction, right? Like, one of the things that I really appreciate about what Kingsnorth says is that the quote-unquote machine is driven by mainly left-brain sorts of features, right? So he talks about scientism, like the thinking of the world in a naturalistic, scientific way only, rationalism, and ultimately there's this kind of cold, bleak view of the world. If you think about like things like AI, it's all about efficiency. That's all left-brain sort of thinking. Guess what's not that way? Art.
Right.
And poetry.
And music.
And beauty and music.
Yep.
And those are things we've talked about so much that those are great practices because they're just a totally different way of viewing the world that you can't even necessarily give an account for why this strikes a chord in you. But guess what? Beauty is and art and music, all of those things are not efficient. And that's a completely different category. It's not a way of viewing the world, but it's something that we all crave. And so spending time in the arts is something that is a way of resisting and fighting back mm-hmm. against the pull of, you know, especially kind of all the rigidity and efficiency of the machine.
Yes, and I think all of that is deeply related to what does it mean to be human? Because one of the things that Kingsnorth talks about that he stole from Lewis and Tolkien is that part of what it means to be human is to be a creator, that nothing else, no other animal species creates in the way that humans do. Animals do not compose music. Animals do not paint things like The Last Supper. This whole idea that humans are nothing but animals is a reductionistic view of the world that militates against the way that God made us. And so Lewis and Tolkien would say the more that we live into beauty, the more that we live into creativity, the more that we lean into all of these art forms, the more we are living into being human, because being human is to be made in the image of God, to be made well, and to, even though we are sinners because of original sin, that image of God is still within us, and that when we are makers, we most truly live into that.
Well,
yeah,
it's probably time to
I could go on and on, and so could you.
I'm sure we probably will. Where did John go? Who's got? Is he there? He is. All right. How are we doing on questions?
We got quite a bit. Yeah, we got quite a bit. If you want to go ahead and take this time to upvote the questions you want me to ask first, or if you have a question, go ahead and submit your questions right now. I'll go ahead and ask the first question. What is your opinion of pastors using AI to help write sermons and communicate with their congregations? What are your personal rules for using AI?
That is an excellent question, and I will start with the caveat of I don't want to judge people when I don't know their circumstances, but I would say for me personally, I would never use AI working on a sermon. I feel like that's just antithetical to trying to... My view of a sermon is that you should be engaging with the Word of God prayerfully and trying to figure out what it is that the Holy Spirit may want to bring to light through the sermon. And part of that will involve research, and I will maybe use like Google search, but not like AI. If I'm trying to find a particular quotation that I'm looking for, but beyond that, I would just not feel comfortable with that. And the other thing is that AI is wrong a lot of the time. And it's just wrong. I was on a trip with some friends this summer, and part of what we had to do on the trip is each place we went, somebody had to give a little talk about what we were going to go see, and some of the people used AI, and it would tell them things that were just wrong. So, like, there's a famous English architect named Inigo Jones, who was from Wales, and the person that was giving the little speech about him said he was from Italy. And I was like, what? And there was like, well, that's what Grok said. And I was like, well, Grok is wrong. So, yeah, so I personally just don't really use AI. I think there probably are some uses of it that could be helpful, but I have not really engaged with those.
Yeah, that's a good way of framing it. I do have a couple of friends who are pastors who use it in what I would say would be an ethical way. But I think to step back and say what I think a sermon is logic on fire coming through a person. And as you talked about prayer and God and the scriptures, that's something that can't be replaced by an outside agent. It's only through God, the Holy Spirit, and the scriptures and my soul, right?
Right.
And preparing that way. I will say the ways that I found people use it well, I think, one of the ways I used AI this week was comparing school security systems. Like these two things, I'm like, give me an evaluation. And I was like, okay, this one is going to be more for larger scales, and this one's more of a startup. So it's like, okay, that can be helpful. A brief analysis. That's totally different than writing a sermon, right? And so somebody who, I think what you have to protect against is making sure that it's your own work, right? And so against plagiarism, but also the, as we talked about already, the work itself is first and foremost through me to a congregation by the power of the Holy Spirit. But the way that I've heard a friend of mine use it is critique this sermon that he's written fully in the lens of Pastor A, B, and C that he admires. And because their sermons are out there, it's a particular lens. And he said it's actually been kind of helpful. It's helped him to say this is what they would critique. I'm just telling you what, and we can disagree. We sometimes have. But I actually found that to be, I've never done that myself, but he said that's been a helpful. Well, how would you differentiate if I said, hey, Brian, let me share this sermon with you that I wrote and critique me?
That is an embodied reality of somebody that knows and loves you.
Yeah.
AI does not know you. It does not love you.
That's true. And I wouldn't say that. So I would completely agree that's really helpful. But in terms of content, there can be certain – I wouldn't say it's an all or nothing.
No. I'm going to push back on that because I know we need to go to the next question.
Yeah, let's keep going
on
this.
But part of the problem with that is that AI is biased. It is biased. And so it will not give you an honest critique. It is being filtered through algorithms of somebody's opinion about what those other preachers are saying. So
even if you gave them you have to give it, and that I admittedly am not good at. I just haven't tried. But there are some people I know, not in this realm, but like who are incredibly good at giving it the parameters it needs. But we should move on,
yes.
I think, from this.
Yes.
But I do think there is a place for like a law clerk. You know, those are the things that AI.
Yeah, when it's just data marshaling. So
a sermon is not a helpful category right
yes.
now to be exploring.
Yes.
But like.
Yes.
Anyways, we'll continue
right.
this later.
Moving right along.
Yeah.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on aliens, if they exist?
That's what
how
AI
does
is.
This impact the Christian faith?
It's like a legit thing, though, right now. Like, there's a number of people. It wasn't. I haven't paid close enough attention, other than knowing there's conversations about this. Isn't there been a?
There are a lot of conversations.
Well,
about
there's
it.
Always been, but
I mean, I used to be fascinated with aliens when I was little. Y'all won't remember this, but there was, because you're so much younger than I am, but there was a great TV show when I was 5 called My Favorite Martian that you should, like, look up on YouTube. It was quite entertaining. But I think this whole idea about worrying about aliens and about whether the person that you're working with is, like, secretly a zombie or something like that, that's
those
crazy.
Those aren't the same thing.
But they can be.
Okay.
I wouldn't worry about it if you're a Christian. I think the Bible can give space if there are, in fact, intelligent life forms
yes,
outside.
Yes,
so that's my short
yes.
answer.
There's a great C.S. Lewis essay about that.
Really?
So, yes,
of
believe it or not. About rocketry.
All right.
Yeah. All right. So.
Great question.
Positively
defined.
Alien. What is the Christian worldview? As in something other than the negative definition, a.k.a. not modernism.
Oh, that's great. He actually spends the first little few pages talking. If I heard the question right, what is the Christian
yes,
worldview?
Yes.
Defined
positively
yeah,
rather than negatively.
That's so important. You should absolutely define it positively instead of something else. And you can do it in 4 words. Creation, fall, redemption, and restoration. So you think about God. There is a God who reveals himself, who created the world, who gave human beings this incredible dignity in God's image, and of their own freedom have chosen to rebel against God, go their own way, and have incurred a terrible penalty where they've been infected in their entire posterity with this curse of being turned in on themselves. And God in his grace has come running after his creation that wanted to go elsewhere, and he has wooed them to himself and has ultimately died in their place, risen again to defeat the curse and bring them back to their everlasting home. That is ultimately the story, the worldview. And so if you think about that's the world we're living in, that's the story in which we see ourselves, that changes everything as opposed to just a cold, efficient, you know, empty universe.
Yeah.
But there is a personal God who wants to relate to me, who's made the world, who's caused me to be dependent upon him and upon others, and that those limits, that dependency is a good thing.
Yes, yes.
Sorry.
I just say amen to that. Okay. So.
Thoughts on believing in both God and science and appreciating innovation while also being a Christian?
Absolutely.
It's important.
Yes, I think that science is a gift of God. There's a lot of, and again, Lewis is a great person to read on this because Lewis was a huge fan of science. And one of the great things that I would commend to everybody to do, if you ever have the opportunity to go to Cambridge University in England, do the Christian Heritage Walking Tour, because what you will learn is that virtually every major scientist that you studied about, whether it is Crick and Watson and DNA or Boyle with physics or Isaac Newton or all of these different scientists, were people who were deeply committed to the Christian faith. And so the whole reason that the whole role of science started exploding as the Middle Ages moved into the Renaissance was this understanding that God had created an ordered world that we could discover truth about. And so I think that seeing science as a gift of God is really important, and seeing innovation when it's done well as a gift of God. Like, as we said last time, I'm so grateful for antibiotics and for Novocaine. you know, those are innovations, but those are good innovations that help our humanity to prosper.
It, when used in the right way, because even those can be taken beyond
in a bad
and perverted
right. yes.
into
yes.
bad ends, right? But yeah, I think looking at the people who were doing this were motivated out of their faith, and the fact that science is basically observing things that happen and trying to come to the conclusion of cause and effect and the laws that are there. Well, those laws are tethered to a person, to the God who
and
made
a reality.
And the reality
yeah.
of the world. And so
yeah.
They're very. It's not only like possible to have science and faith, but I would say it's absolutely essential to have science connected to faith to be able to understand science correctly.
And if you're interested in that, just a book plug. One of the great books on science and religion is by a guy named Sir John Polkinghorne, who was an eminent particle physicist at Cambridge University and was president of one of the colleges there. And he became converted to the Christian faith through studying physics, to the point that he, after his PhD, went on and did theological studies and became an Anglican priest as well. So he has a little book about science and religion that's really good.
As someone who is extremely left brain, I don't understand art, but find great joy in complex Excel sheet or a huge math problem. Is that also art?
No.
Yes, sort of. Sort of. So I would say that mathematics, pure mathematics, is art because it is a reflection of the order and creativity of the mind of God. And the fact that mathematics works is only possible because of the way that God structured reality. And there's some wonderful work that has been done by scholars on the connection between mathematics and music and how both of those are, in some ways, two sides of the same coin in terms of art. Computer programs, maybe there can be an artistic element to that, but I would be loath to go too far down that road.
I'm going to go the four mathematical arts, the quadrivium.
Yes.
You mentioned one of them, music, mm-hmm. right? But you've got arithmetic. So these are the mathematical arts of arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy.
Astronomy, yep.
And they're about number and like basically adding number in time, number in space, and then astronomy is number in time and space. But music is absolutely about the mathematical patterns of number throughout time.
Mm-hmm.
And there can absolutely be a beauty to that that we should appreciate. But I would say the linguistic arts as well of being able, there's something about actual human language as in addition to numbers that is integral to our humanity that is important. And I could have written this question because I'm more math drawn and minded, I think more left brain. I like that. And I would encourage you to keep with it and to try and read. Lewis's children's stories are a great place to start because mm-hmm. they're easy, but there's something beautiful about it. And of course, he always said, you know, the Narnia series or even Harry Potter, whatever you want to. A good children's story is only going to get better as you become older.
Yes,
and so
that's right.
That can be a great place to start if you are more left
trying
brain
to stretch.
Like me.
Yes.
Would you say there is no amount of AI that is ethical to use? Should we try to eliminate it from our lives or just learn to use it reasonably?
That is also an excellent question. And I think that the answer to that is that it's really too early to tell. I would say it appears to me that there are some ways to ethically use AI, but I think it is a very slippery slope. And there are some theologians that would very definitely say you should not have anything to do with AI at all, period, end of statement. I don't think I'm quite at that place, but I also am very far from saying we should fully embrace it.
Yeah, I would actually be in agreement with you. I think I am more on the end of saying that because it's so early to tell, and because, as you said rightly a moment ago about it's not unbiased that these are giving particular things, and I'm very cautious with it right now. I think King's North is certainly on the end of the spectrum that would say no, absolutely not. There are Christians that would make the argument on the other side that, and it's not kind of a fatalistic, like, it's here, we're going to have to live with it, but it's more like, no, this is a tool, and we should be able to have Christians think about the world and the way it ought to be and be on the cutting edge of that tool.
So if you watched The Lord of the Rings and heard Boromir talk about the Ring of Power.
I I'm going to agree completely with you. I'm not on that end of the spectrum. I'm just saying there are Christians who take
who
that.
Who are, yes.
I'm with you saying that they're wrong.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Wonderful. Boy. what's the next one?
Wouldn't we want Christians to be making decisions about AI and technology rather than removing ourselves from it entirely?
That's exactly what I was saying just now. Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you. You agree with me.
Yes, I do.
My boss asked me if I thought Allah and God were the same God. I told him no. Can you please explain why they differ so greatly?
Yes, so that was the correct answer that you told your boss, whoever was asking that. When you look at what the Quran teaches about Allah, and you look at what the Bible teaches about God, they are clearly not the same entity. So Allah is an unknowable, someone that you cannot have a personal relationship with. He is someone who is in heaven and has very high expectations of behavior from his followers, and he is one solitary personality. The Christian understanding is that God is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, which is heresy punishable by death in Islam, to say that, and that one of the big differences is that in Christianity and our understanding of God is the one that takes the initiative to come and enter into our world to save us. Allah is much more like a God who needs to be appeased. So very, very different conceptions. And there's much more to say, but that's sort of the basic difference.
Yes, and amen. And I would say good on you for, I mean, there can be a way that can be very tense, I think, in that kind of conversation, but to stay as factual, because it would be wrong to say that they're the same. But that sounds like a hard conversation that is kudos on you for answering truthfully.
Yes.
How do I fight the desire for quick answers in today's society as I ask God questions that don't feel answered?
That is the human dilemma. Yeah, I think one of the things that has been perhaps the most pernicious and awful part of what has happened to our culture as it has gone more and more in this direction of the machine is our ability to wait and to be patient for anything has just evaporated, like our attention span. I think one of the ways to begin to try to combat that is to focus on things that are eternal and unchanging, to meditate on truths about God, to spend time outside in nature, which doesn't sound like this is going to help with what you're talking about, but I think that actually is part of the solution, to get yourself out of thinking that the thing that you are worried about and that you need to make a decision about is the most important thing in the history of the world, and to sort of give yourself permission to not know. And sometimes you just don't know and you have to do the best you can. And that's part of what it means to be human. And that's okay.
Has anybody read the book of Job in the Old Testament? A number of you. As we're talking about artificial intelligence and efficiency and quickly summarize, that's a book of all the books that I think this day and age cannot read.
Yes.
It's hard enough for me to read 20 years ago. It's like, what is it, 38 chapters, 40 chapters, something like that, 42? And it's like 38 chapters of the same thing over and over, pondering the ultimate questions of life. Why is this suffering happening
without
to me?
Without any satisfactory
and
answer.
And not getting a satisfactory answer until like 38 chapters later, and you're like, oh my goodness. But that very question is so good, because part of the Christian life is not just Googling and getting your answer, but the process of going to God and that actual method and pouring out your soul and wrestling, and you're not God. AI is going to convince you that you can get answers that you should comprehend, but if there is a God and he's infinite, we're not going to be able to comprehend him fully.
Yeah.
And part of that relationship needs to have that dynamic at play of, I'm going to wrestle about these important questions to and with God. Sorry, that was just me processing out loud that, but... Couple more.
I had a pastor tell me that non-believers shouldn't come up during communion to receive just a blessing. They should stay seated. Does that sound right to you?
I don't know the pastor and I don't know the context, but that is not what I would say if I were asked that question. I think that God can bless people who are not believers, and that part of that blessing might be opening their eyes to be able to see him. Jesus talks about how God sends his rain on the just and the unjust, and sends the sun on the just and the unjust. And so I think that my understanding is that we are blessing people in the name of God who are created in his image, whether they have understood that or not.
That's a good way of putting it. I do think that there's, I have served in many contexts where the idea of why would you not give communion to everybody is probably the more basic question. This is a very specific question about coming up and still not receiving communion. The point there is that I do think that there is a time where the church down through the ages has understood that if there's a notorious, grievous sin where you have not repented of this and it's public and people have tried to help you to repent and you are obstinate, they would disbar you from the table, basically. I would agree with you that I think there's a place to come up and you're still not receiving. But sometimes in not receiving communion, or maybe this to give this pastor, I don't know, the benefit of the doubt, the idea is that's meant to cause in you
reflection
yeah. and to grieve you so that you would amend your life. And so I think that's probably where this pastor is coming from, although I would agree with you that would be the way I would go in terms of come up for a blessing in that instance.
Yeah. All right. Maybe one more.
One more.
Why are people waiting to get married so late? What downstream effect is this having on the biblical mandate of marriage and society?
Oh, boy.
We did a whole four-part series.
So there is a great – go back in the podcast archive and listen to our series on the defining decade, book by Meg Jay, about thriving in your 20s. And one of her major arguments is that one of the most disastrous things that has happened – not just in the Christian faith, but in the culture, is this whole idea of postponing marriage and postponing marriage and postponing marriage, that it is really unhelpful. And I think it's directly related to a lot of what is in this book, because so many of the people that I talk to who are postponing marriage, the reasons that they give are almost exclusively economic. That I need to get the right job and I need to have enough money where I can buy a house and send my children to the right school before I can get into a relationship. And I think that is absolutely 180 degrees wrong. So
yeah. And the place element too. I think afraid we don't want to close down options, and so we feel like we have to pursue our own independence and to actually eliminate options, commit to one person and settle down in one place together.
Right, and grow together.
And grow together is so against the machine that it is really challenging. But I do think for the good of society, we're going to have to make that more plausible for people. And to recognize that there's joy in that counterintuitively.
So. Yes, and I would say part of the misunderstanding is that we think when we go into marriage, we have to have the perfect relationship and we have to be the perfect person. But the fact of the matter is marriage is two broken people coming together as Christians, hopefully, two broken people redeemed by Jesus who are going to try to grow together in this relationship. And that is a profoundly different construct than looking for the perfect person who you will not ever find. So
yes, that's a good note to end on.
Perhaps, yes. So thank y'all so much for coming tonight. I hope you will read this book and come back and join us on June the 9th, next time when we will be here.
Thanks
and feel free to hang out.
Yeah.